I'm Christopher Lydon, exploring the American mind. The American Civil War that saved the Union remade the American way of thinking in Louis Menand's story of the Metaphysical Club. Tragic wars like Vietnam do such things, but the Civil War produced an American philosophy, pragmatism, in a word, skepticism, pluralism, relativism, experimentalism, in a few more. Just as Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. was one father of it, he'd been a volunteer from Harvard and a hero, thrice wounded in the Civil War. Nobody entered the fray with grander ideals. Nobody left more shattered at the hideous waste of war. Twin evil with slavery, he decided, slavery's parent, child, and sustainer. His lesson was that certitude leads to violence. What the war cost the likes of Holmes, William James, John Dewey, and Charles Peirce was belief in their beliefs. Louis Menand's account of a war that gave birth to an ism is next, as the conversation continues. Audio streaming is provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting comes from ENA, Eric Nelson Architects, providing creative solutions for living and working on the web at ena-ma.com. And from Gail Leander Public Relations, helping authors publicize their progressive books. Contact glpr at aol.com. And from Suzanne and Bob Petrucci. I'm Christopher Lydon. Our guest, Louis Menand, has written a book like none I've ever read about a war that gave birth to a philosophy. Pragmatism, as an answer to the horrific clash of principles in the American Civil War. The book is a group portrait of ideas and of men rethinking their battle scars and the sins of their fathers. The remarkable thing is that they're revisiting the war as a failure not of politics and policy, but of ideas. They're thinking about thinking and the very nature of belief and of truth in American life. Pragmatism was their answer, though the psychologist William James preferred the name humanism. Judge Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., another main player, might have called it experimentalism. The educator John Dewey said it was about the unity of knowing and doing. We're talking about the making of the modern American mind this hour with the writer, Louis, known as Luke Menand. Our phone is 617-450-2923. Give him a call. His book is called The Metaphysical Club, A Story of Ideas in America. Welcome, Luke Menand. You said you hated to finish writing this book. I hated to finish reading it. The ideas sit up and talk in this book, and the men, I got to say, are all flesh and spirit. I wish you'd just plunge into maybe the most colorful of them, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., one of the great anti-dogmatic judges in American legal history. Fought in the Civil War, served in the U.S. Supreme Court into Franklin Roosevelt's time. He said, the life of the law has not been logic, it's been experience. That's a pragmatist idea through and through. How did he get there?
Thank you. It's very nice to be on the show with you. And Holmes really is one of the most interesting of the four people I write about in the book. The others are William James, Charles Sanders Peirce, and John Dewey. But the book begins with Holmes, and the reason Holmes is so important to the story is because of the four, he was the only one who fought in the war. He enlisted in the Union Army, dropped out of Harvard to do so in the spring of 1861, right after Fort Sumter was fired upon. He was in the Massachusetts 20th Regiment, which suffered the fourth highest number of battle casualties of any regiment in the Union Army. There were over 2,000 of them. And he himself was wounded in the war three times. He was shot in the chest at Ball's Bluff in his first engagement, almost died. He was then shot in the neck at Antietam, and he was left behind enemy lines briefly for dead. Then the Union troops recovered the ground, and he was evacuated safely. And finally, he was shot in the foot in a battle known as Second Fredericksburg, and he actually hoped his foot would have to be amputated because that would allow him to be discharged. But the foot was spared, and he went back and served out the rest of his commission. He was a very heroic and valiant soldier, but he found the war a horrific experience. And one of the arguments I try to make in the book is that his disillusionment, as you said at the top, with the ideals that had prompted him to enlist and to go to war, his disillusionment with the war itself and the waste that the war caused to his generation, is part of the reason that he developed a philosophy of jurisprudence that gets called pragmatist, even though that's a word that Holmes certainly would never have used himself. The sentence that you quote, the life of the law has not been logic, it has been experience, is the third sentence of his book called The Common Law, which was published in 1881, and the book that kind of made his career as a legal thinker. He then went on to serve on the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts for 20 years, and then in 1902 to the Supreme Court of the United States, where he served for 30 years. The life of the law has not been logic, it has been experience. What Holmes meant by that was that law was being taught as a system of formal principles, which were all logically interrelated, as it were, a system of abstractions based on some abstract, transcendent idea of justice. What Holmes tried to show in this book, The Common Law, was that the history of the law shows that, in fact, the law is a system of tools that people use, societies use, to adapt to changing conditions. It doesn't refer to some, what he called, a brooding omnipresence in the sky, some set of abstractions that we have to intuit by studying particular cases. Instead, we can understand the law by looking at social situations and seeing how societies have tried to deal with those situations by enacting laws and by enforcing or not enforcing them.
He's famous for many phrases, all of which have pragmatism embedded in them somewhere. The idea that life is an experiment. The idea that he said, I don't know if this was a legal ruling or not, but he said, when you know that you know, persecution comes easy. Yeah. He didn't like people who knew what they knew. He said, what I mean by truth is the path I have to travel.
Yeah. Yeah, those are all from different places in Holmes's writing. The place in which he says life is an experiment.
That was a ruling.
That was, yeah, probably his most famous opinion. It's a dissent in a case called Abrams against the United States, which is his most famous free speech opinion. The Abrams case was decided in 1919, and it arose out of the First World War. It involved some agitators who were opposed to American involvement in the First World War, and although the majority of the court thought that those people could be jailed for the expression of their opinion, Holmes disagreed, and he wrote this famous dissent. And in the dissent, he says, the Constitution is an experiment, as all life is an experiment. Now, how does that relate to the idea that the life of the law is experience? What he means is that the Constitution is not something that is the only way that things must be. The Constitution is an experiment in democratic living, and we live within the terms of that experiment. And part of those terms, part of the conditions of democracy, is that individuals can express their opinions even when they're repulsive to the majority. And it's not as though Holmes had a kind of sentimental idea that human beings have a right to their opinions just because they're human beings. He thought talk like that was balderdash. Hmm. He said once about one of his free speech opinions, I have just upheld the right of a donkey to drool. So it wasn't as though he admired the views of the people he defended in those opinions. But he thought that democracy depended upon an exchange of ideas. Why? Because what was the alternative? The alternative was violence. And that's what the Civil War represented to him, and it's part of his reaction against that made him a staunch defender of civil liberties at the end of his life.
Yeah, well, that was interesting. I hadn't been clear on that distinction he drew, that, as he said, we permit free expression of ideas not because some individual may have the right one, right. Essentially nobody can, but because we need the whole group to get the ideas we need. Thinking, he said, is a social activity. Holmes is classically in this book, I mean, but he's one of those mega minds and genius stylists who I never saw whole as I do in this book. And it's rooted in the Civil War. A lot of it is rooted in a moment, I think it was at Ball's Bluff, when he thought he was dying.
Yeah.
I wish you'd sort of reenact that moment in which he wrote about so keenly in his war journal.
Yeah, Holmes during the war, when he was a soldier, he's very young, he was 21, 22, and very youthful. In fact, in appearance, he was 6'3", but he weighed only 136 pounds, so you can imagine the physical ordeal that he went through. In his first battle, which was at Ball's Bluff, it was in October 1861. Now, the context was that the Union Army had suffered its famous terrible rout in the first Battle of Bull Run that summer, and the general of the Army of the Potomac, George McClellan, was very reluctant to get engaged again with the Confederate Army. But this annoyed the Lincoln administration, who thought that McClellan should be doing something. So McClellan ordered one of his generals, Charles Stone, to make what he called a slight demonstration against Confederate forces in Virginia by crossing the Potomac from Maryland and attacking into Virginia. And this was the Battle of Ball's Bluff that October. That was Holmes's first battle. Ball's Bluff is an acclivity on the Virginia side of the Potomac River, about 40 miles upriver from Washington, about 100 feet high. I've actually visited it. It's, of course, a national park. And it's amazing how both small the spaces in which thousands of soldiers fired each other and how steep this cliff is, that for some reason or other, the Union general thought it was a wise idea to use as a way to get into Virginia. What happened was there was a Confederate force at the top of the bluff hidden in the trees, which the Union soldiers didn't know. So they ferried over the river, they climbed up the bluff, carrying big artillery pieces with them, and when they got to the top, they were ambushed essentially by the Confederate forces, driven back down the bluff into the river. Many of them drowned. Most of them were just shot like ducks from the top of the bluff, and the artillery pieces, of course, came crashing down. Holmes was wounded very early in that engagement, so he was evacuated safely, but he was shot just above the heart through the chest. And when he was taken to the hospital, which was on an island in the Potomac, he was told that he might die. So the amazing thing about the story is that he then sat there thinking to himself, well, does this experience make me reconsider my religious views? And I'll read the passage from his diary that he wrote about it. When I thought I was dying, the reflection that the majority vote of the civilized world declared that with my opinions I was en route for hell came up with painful distinctness. That is, because he didn't believe in God, he must be going to hell. Perhaps the first impulse was tremulous, but then I said, by Jove, I die like a soldier anyhow. I was shot in the breast, doing my duty up to the hub. Afraid? No, I am proud. Then I thought, I couldn't be guilty of a deathbed recantation. Father and I had talked of that and were agreed that it generally meant nothing but a cowardly giving way to fear. Besides, thought I, can I recant if I want to? Has the approach of death changed my beliefs much? And at this I answered, no. Then came in my philosophy. I am to take a leap in the dark. But now, as ever, I believe that whatever shall happen is best, for it is in accordance with the general law, and good and universal or general law are synonymous terms in the universe. Would the complex forces which made a still more complex unit in me resolve themselves back into simpler forms? Or would my angel be still winging his way onward when eternities had passed? I could not tell. But all was doubtless well, and so, with a God forgive me if I'm wrong, I slept.
What a testament.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing to think that Holmes would be lying there, 22 years old, thinking that he's about to die, bleeding from a wound in his chest, and that he would sort of road test his beliefs. He would sort of say, well, now, what do I believe, and do I still believe under these circumstances? Very typical of the man. There's a great deal of amazing intellectual detachment in his personality.
I'm to take a leap in the dark. There's a little bit of life as an experiment right there.
There is indeed. Yeah.
You mentioned he mentions in that passage his father, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes, the autocrat of the breakfast table, sort of Mr. Boston in his time, who's revealed in your book as a blowhard, a kind of compulsive talker, opinion monger, racist, sexist, like all of them. I don't want to get too far ahead of the game, but a lot of this story, it seems to me, is sons rebelling against their fathers. And he was showing up his father, both in battle and in the rest of his life. A lot of these guys were.
Yeah, I just would say, I think my characterization of Dr. Holmes is a little kinder than what you just said, but he did represent the...
He's a very clever man, yeah. No question.
Yeah, very clever, talented in many areas. Of course, he wrote famous poetry like Old Ironsides that everybody knows in Boston. I learned as when I was in school. He wrote novels, but he was also dean of the Harvard Medical School. He wrote a very famous paper on the germ theory of disease when he was a young man. And he was supposed to be the greatest talker that people had ever heard, a brilliant conversationalist. But he represented the old Boston view, the antebellum view, in which Boston was the center of the universe.
He was the first one to call it the hub of the universe.
That's correct. Dr. Holmes is the man who coined the phrase, Boston is the hub of the solar system. The hub is his nickname. What his son did was, their relations were fairly fractious. His son was also a brilliant talker, but they were quite different temperamentally. What his son did was to reject the idea that Boston was the center of the universe, and to reject the idea that any place was the center of the universe. He became kind of a cosmopolitan professional, and he narrowed himself in his study of the law. The only thing he was really interested in was the law. The only thing that he really wanted to do was to be successful as a great judge. In contrast to his father, who was a kind of belletristic, expansive, generalist kind of intellectual. And that contrast is very much the contrast between the intellectual culture of the North before the war in the 1840s and 50s and the intellectual culture in the second half of the 19th century.
I wish you'd introduce William James, who had another sort of father-son thing going. And his father, Henry James Sr., father, of course, of the great novelist, was also, in many lights, a foolish figure in this story. And I think William James is trying to get away from the mysticism, a lot of the nonsense, a lot of the sort of wandering of his old man. He didn't fight in the Civil War, but he certainly lived the experience. Introduce the great William.
Yeah, William James, is one of the more extraordinary intellectuals in American history, and his connection with Holmes is actually quite intimate. He and Holmes were best friends. They became friends right after the war was over, 1865, and they used to meet regularly every Saturday with a bottle of rum and get together and talk about philosophy. It's the kind of thing William James liked to do, and Holmes could talk about anything, so it was a great relationship. And they were really intimate, but later on they separated. They both got married, and they also felt temperamentally quite different. But that's how William James first gets into the story. As you say, William James's father is an extraordinary character. He was an eccentric religious philosopher. He began as a rebel against Calvinism, which had been his father's religion. His father was an Irish immigrant. And he eventually became a Swedenborgian, a follower of the Danish theologian Emanuel Swedenborg, who believed that angels had given him the truth about the nature of the universe. But even then, Henry James Sr. was kind of an eccentric Swedenborgian, and he spent most of his time arguing with the orthodox Swedenborgians in America. William James loved his father, who was an exceptional, loving, very liberal-minded parent who doted on his children. He had five altogether, or at least doted on the male children. He had a daughter, Alice, who was famously troubled. But in many ways, William James's career, as you point out, much like his friend Holmes's career, was a matter of separating himself intellectually from his father and his father's world, and particularly from the idea, I think, that was very typical of the older generation represented by Henry James Sr., Dr. Holmes, some of the other figures I talk about in the book, the idea that the universe is an idea, that the universe has some kind of abstract meaning which guides us, which we can't really have access to, but whose terms we would violate at our peril. Pragmatism is very much the idea that the universe isn't an idea, that there is nothing out there that we can't know directly, but which is nevertheless controlling our lives. That's where the idea of experimentation comes in. William James was one of the great experimentalists of his time, and his favorite subject was himself. He would take any drug, sniff any vial of chemicals he found lying around the laboratory. He hypnotized himself. He went into all kinds of weird therapy. He loved to experiment on his own consciousness, and that's what makes him such a lovable figure, really.
As you write, William James spent his life, in a fashion, defending what were thought at the time to be exclusive worldviews, modern science on one hand, including all the drugs maybe, and religious faith. You end up calling him a man of two minds, a kind of indecisive character. I must say, I read him as a man of almost perfect, exquisite balance and ambiguity, who felt he didn't have to make up his mind, and who could defend not both sides of the question exactly, but in the best of a pragmatic mode, see the value of both. as they produce good results. It was his notion that you test an idea by its effects,
right.
And if an idea has good effects, it's probably a good idea. It gives you a funny definition of truth. But make your argument that he just couldn't make up his mind.
Well, I think what you say is fair about him, but the thing to remember is that he spent really the first 10 years of his adulthood, really until his mid-30s, wrestling with his inability to make up his mind. Mm-hmm. He had a terrible time deciding, for example, whether he should be a philosopher or a scientist.
Or a painter or a doctor, I guess.
He went to Harvard Medical School, got a medical degree, never practiced medicine, which is typical. He spent 2 years courting the woman he married. He kept changing his mind about whether they should be married. He was constantly in a dither, and it drove him into a terrible depression. He was depressed for several years, couldn't read, couldn't write, couldn't go out. What happened, I think, is that he found a way to convert his temperamental indecisiveness into a kind of virtue. And as you say, pragmatism for him represented that ability to see the merits in opposed positions. The point you make is right, that pragmatism for James was actually an argument for God. When we think of pragmatism as experimentalism, as growing out of Darwinism, as a kind of relativism, we tend to think of it as a rather worldly and unreligious philosophy. But that's not how James thought of it. James introduced pragmatism as a way to say, it's okay to believe in God, even if we can't prove scientifically that God exists, if our belief in God gets us into a better relationship with the world. It's something he very much wished for himself, though he was never able successfully to have a belief in God or to have prayer work for him. But he was extremely sympathetic to the religious mind. But that's one of the reasons that he and Holmes went their separate ways, because Holmes felt that James was way too sentimental and soft-hearted about the issue of religion. Holmes wanted to sort of get rid of the whole idea of spirituality, which he thought was kind of mysticism. But James was very open to it, and it is part of his temperament that he was a great scientist, the first modern American psychologist, and at the same time someone very interested in religion. And of course, everybody knows his great book on religion, The Varieties of Religious Experience.
Which was respectful, to put it mildly.
Except to Catholics, yeah.
I want you to sketch in some of the kind of intellectual on the Cambridge-Harvard background, because they weren't reacting just to the Civil War. They were reacting to all kinds of pseudoscience and a kind of what reads now like just an awful humbug certainty with great Harvard professorships behind it. Louis Agassiz, the worst among them. But people who were racists and male chauvinists and sexists of the deepest double-dyed kind, with a sort of scientific rationale that seems so childish and so transparent now. I mean, one understands why these people are saying no.
Yeah, the one way to put this is to say that there was a double whammy in the 1860s. The first, of course, was the Civil War, which we've talked about. Second was On the Origin of Species. On the Origin of Species was published in 1859, Darwin's great book, and that completely changed the way that scientific thought was pursued, everywhere, but in America too. Now, the person you mentioned, Louis Agassiz, was the great anti-Darwinist of his day. Agassiz is a fascinating character, and probably people in Boston are familiar with Agassiz buildings and Agassiz's name.
Agassiz glass flowers and the Agassiz Museum.
That's right. The part of it is because of Louis Agassiz, and part of it is because of his son, Alexander Agassiz, who was also a big Harvard figure and became very wealthy from copper mining. Louis Agassiz was from Switzerland, and he came to the United States in 1848, he gave a series of lectures in Boston that were so popular that Harvard basically created a scientific school to retain Agassiz on the faculty, and he became a Harvard professor. He was an extraordinarily charismatic man. He was large, he had black hair, black eyes, he had a delicious French accent. Audiences found him fascinating, and he had a very great popular touch. He was able to talk about science. He's quite learned to audiences of non-specialists, and so he was a huge
kind of popularizer of his scientific views. Now, his scientific views were pre-Darwinian, so he thought that the species were fixed, that God had created the species the way they are. And it's one consequence of that view, which is prevalent all over the Western world in the years before Darwin, was that the races are arranged hierarchically by the Creator, with, of course, the white race at the top and the African race or the black race at the bottom. And Agassiz, before he came to the United States, had never given much attention to the question of anthropology or the races. But when he came here, he fell under the influence of various American scientists who were very big in promoting this view of racial hierarchy, and he became a great champion of it. So that in the years leading up to the Civil War, and even during the Civil War, he was a kind of spokesman for the idea that the races must be kept separate. His great fear was what we now call miscegenation, racial interbreeding, because he thought that that would would degrade the species. It would create mongrel types, as he called them. The great story about William James and Agassiz is that William James was a student of Agassiz, and Agassiz went to Brazil in 1865 on an expedition specifically to refute the theories of Charles Darwin, and William went along with him. He was then a young man, about 23, 24. He went to Brazil with Agassiz. What Agassiz did in Brazil was to study Brazilian population, the people of Brazil, which is a mixed-race population, mixed races of Indians, that is Aboriginal Americans, Europeans, and Africans. And his purpose in studying them was to prove that racial interbreeding caused a decline in the quality of the human type. That's the kind of thinking that the pragmatists in the book, the figures, the central figures in my book, are trying to work their way out of and to react against.
You know, the trip to Brazil, you say, was kind of his Civil War. He didn't serve, but he was not untouched by the Civil War, William James. Louis Menand, I wish you'd just read William James's speech at the dedication of the famous Robert Gould Shaw Memorial, Robert Gould Shaw having led black troops. He was a great Boston aristocrat who led a black unit in the Civil War, and James spoke at the dedication of his monument. I wish you'd just read it. To me, it's a perfect example of William James's elegance and the prose.
Yeah, I'll read it. Just to set the context for it, of course, William James had three brothers, and everybody knows Henry, but there were two younger brothers, Wilkie James and Robertson James. And both Wilkie and Bob James did serve in the Civil War. They did enlist, and they both served in all-black as officers in all-black regiments. Wilkie James was a member of Shaw's regiment. As everybody knows, Shaw was killed on the assault in Fort Wagner, in South Carolina, and Wilkie James was badly wounded in that. So when St. Gaudens Memorial was erected in Boston Common, William James was invited to give a speech there, and this is the speech. He said that what made Shaw admirable was, quote, not the common and gregarious courage of going off to fight. It is that more lonely courage which he showed when he dropped his warm commission in the glorious second to head your dubious fortunes, Negroes of the 54th. That lonely kind of courage, civic courage, as we call it in peace times, is the kind of valor in which the monuments of nations should most of all be reared. For the survival of the fittest has not been bred into the bone of human beings as it has bred military valor, and if 500 of us who could storm a battery side by side with others, perhaps not one could be found who would risk his worldly fortunes all alone in resisting an enthroned abuse. James said that a great nation is not saved by wars, but by acts without external picturesqueness, by speaking, writing, voting reasonably, by smiting corruption swiftly, by good temper between parties, by the people knowing true men when they see them and preferring them as leaders to rabid partisans or empty quacks.
That is the behavior that monuments should honor, he said. You note at the end that, of course, he was talking about
Wilkie.
He was talking about Robert Gould Shaw, yeah. Ceremonially, but he had Wilkie.
Yeah.
The lonely courage of his brother Wilkie.
I think he was thinking of his brother when he said those words. Yeah,
they're beautiful words, and they are the balance and the sweet reason, it seems to me, of the whole pragmatist idea at their best in the words of William James. Louis Menand is our guest. His book is called The Metaphysical Club, which was formed and died quickly in Cambridge in 1872, it changed the way we think in this country. We'll be back after a short break. Audio streaming is provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting comes from Pagito Systems Group, specializing in Java and Linux-based multi-tier application development, www.pagito.com, and from Align Incorporated, a Boston-area Java engineering and consulting firm, and from Elsa Dorfman, Boston's Matthew Brady. Details available at elsa.photo.net. Christopher Lydon, we're talking about The Metaphysical Club, A Story of Ideas in America by our guest Louis Menand, known as Luke. The Metaphysical Club actually came and went for a few months in 1872, and it becomes the sort of hatchery, at least symbolically, of the whole idea of pragmatism. Charles Peirce, son of a famous Harvard mathematician, was a member. There were lots of others. What about the club itself, Luke Menand?
Well, the club is a kind of mythical entity in American intellectual history because very little is known about it. It seems to have been started in January 1872. It seems to have disbanded by the following November. But the one thing that we know about it was that three of the members of the club, which was a philosophy discussion group that met in Cambridge, were William James, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., and Charles Sanders Peirce, you just mentioned. And the only person who ever mentioned the club in his writings later on, the only participant, was Peirce. Many years later, he claimed that it was during meetings of the Metaphysical Club that he first introduced the concept of pragmatism.
Did he put the name on it?
No, he didn't, actually. Well, he claims that he used the term pragmatism in discussions in the club, but he never actually wrote anything containing that word. The person who first introduced pragmatism to the world was William James. Many years after the club met, remember, in 1872, William James gave a lecture in 1898 in which he used the term pragmatism. But he credited Peirce with the idea, and he credited Peirce with the term.
Talk about Peirce. He's a hard man to figure in your book. He may have been the most powerful abstract thinker, but he was also a very elusive target.
Yeah, Peirce is difficult because his personal life was extremely vexed. His father was a very famous mathematician named Benjamin Peirce, big Harvard professor, and kind of a major figure in in American science. Peirce himself was very gifted, obviously. That's quite clear. He was a scientist in many different fields. His work was on the cutting edge of its time. He was also a philosopher. He was the founder of a field called semiotics, the study of signs. He was the first semiotician. And he knew a number of other things as well. But his life was complicated because he was a womanizer, a philanderer, he was a violent man, he was a drug abuser, he had a painful condition of facial neuralgia, which caused him to take morphine, later on cocaine to alleviate the pain. And he was also a very irascible character, so he got fired from every job that he ever had, ultimately got fired from his job as a professor at Johns Hopkins, and then fired from his job at a U.S. scientific agency, and he spent the last 20 years of his life in poverty because he couldn't get any work. He mostly wrote book reviews for The Nation, that's kind of, and William James gave him some money to live on. But he was a brilliant mind. He's very different from the other pragmatists in that, unlike William James, Charles Peirce really did think that the universe was an idea. That is, he did think that the universe had some kind of meaning. It had an order. It was progressing in a particular direction. And his own version of pragmatism, which he later called pragmaticism, because he was so annoyed at the pragmatism of his friend William James, his own version of pragmatism is very Victorian. He was a kind of metaphysician in the grand manner. but he was also a big influence on William James, who admired him for his whole life.
I think it's only fair to say that he's the subject. I mean, he is the subject of a continuing cult. There's a Charles Peirce Society that meets pretty regularly. They have a web page and newsletters, and so we have to be careful about everything we say. I hope maybe some of the Peircians will join us. You can call in at 617-450-2923 and join our guest, Louis Menand, on the subject of the Metaphysical Club. John Dewey was not a member of the club in Cambridge. He formed a metaphysical club in Baltimore, and he's kind of included in the metaphysical entity. What's his spin? And then I want to get to the content of these ideas, how modern and how significant today so many of them are.
Yeah, Dewey's essential part of the story. He's not from Boston. He's not from Cambridge.
Vermont, that's close enough.
It's close enough. He went to the University of Vermont. Then he went to Johns Hopkins, where he got his Ph.D. He's much younger than the others. He's born in 1859. But his father fought in the war, and he actually visited a Civil War battlefield during the war when he was a young child. So he had a quite vivid memory of it and sense of it. Dewey's career was shaped partly at the University of Chicago, which is where he developed his educational theories, for which he's still famous and which are still influential. And then he went to Columbia University and lived the rest of his life in New York.
He also had a brush with the famous Pullman strike, one of the great industrial sort of industrial intellectual tests of the time.
Yeah, the Pullman strike in the 1890s happened when Dewey was at the University of Chicago at the beginning of his career there. In fact, when he first went to Chicago to take his job, he had trouble getting a train into the city because of the strike. The Pullman strike was a great dispute between capital and labor in the 1890s, and the figure on the side of labor, the head of the Railway Workers Union, was Eugene Debs, who later figured in a famous Supreme Court decision of Oliver Wendell Holmes during the First World War, Debs versus United States. The story of the Pullman strike is that the Pullman, who owned, of course, manufactured the Pullman sleeping cars, his workers went out on strike, and Debs took out almost all the rail workers in the western part of the United States out on strike in sympathy with them. And there was a great deal of violence and contention about this strike because people felt that Debs was acting as a dictator by commanding all his workers to go out on strike. It was something that wasn't supposed to happen and was thought to be very offensive. Dewey was very sympathetic to Debs, and he understood that even though Debs lost the strike and the American Railway Union, Debs's union was ruined, and Pullman and the railroads won the strike with the help of the Cleveland administration's intervention, that this nevertheless represented a turning point in American economic relations. And it was part of Dewey's genius to see what that turning point meant, because what it meant was that for the first time people were going to recognize, as kind of a backlash against the effects of the strike, to recognize the importance of allowing labor workers to be engaged somewhat democratically in the conditions of their labor, and to think of labor and business not as enemies, not as antagonists, but as people working together ultimately for a common social good. Dewey had a very ironic temperament. That is, he was a kind of optimist about human relations, and he believed that in the long run that we were all working together for the same goal, and that antagonisms arose just out of a misperception in the short run about where our true interests lay.
It's interesting because you might have expected these people to be sort of knee-jerk, you know, rooters for the proletariat, and in fact they regard the whole, Jane Addams too especially, the whole notion of an antagonistic labor-capital relationship is an illusion, a bad habit of old right. thinking. John Dewey is also associated especially, of course, with education, sort of education in experience, the sort of experience that Holmes elevated. We could get to that, progressive education, but I also just want you to touch on some of the many ideas that come out of this period that really form our world today, and I hadn't appreciated it, but free speech, for example, is elevated by the pragmatists to its sort of modern, almost sacred standing. Academic freedom, assimilationism. Dewey said, I want to see this country American. And that means the English tradition reduced to a strain among the others. They were pluralists. They were integrationists. They were relativists. There's a degree of anti-elitism here. There's a whole theory of plasticity. James sort of anticipates cognitive science when he says, the whole plasticity of the brain sums itself up when we call it an organ in which currents pouring in from the sense organs make with extreme facility paths which do not easily disappear. That is the modern notion that sort of, the whole idea of sort of neural pathways and the neurons that fire together, wire together. I wish you'd sort of take an inventory of the kind of ideas, the 20th century ideas, including the whole elevation of science that come out of this pragmatist moment.
Sure. Well, the passage that you read from James, which appears in his great work, which is called The Principles of Psychology, published in 1890, that's his sort of claim to fame as an academic psychologist and the first real work of modern psychology in the United States. It's a very important quotation because James says that the brain is this plastic organ that takes its shape from the neural pathways that we cut through it. Now, this is very closely related to the pragmatist idea about ideas. On one view, why do we have ideas about the world? Why do we have beliefs about the world? Why does our mind represent the world? Why do I think this is a table and you're sitting there and two equals four and things like that? Well, there's a sort of classical philosophical view that the mind is a mirror of reality, that the purpose of thinking and forming beliefs is to have an objective and accurate representation of the way things really are and to rule out the subjective element in our thought. What the pragmatist did was to say, that doesn't make any sense on a Darwinian theory. Because under Darwinian theory, you'd have to say minds developed to be like mirrors because it helped us to survive. It doesn't help us to survive to have the mind work as a mirror. It helps us to survive to have a mind that can create beliefs and ideas that help us cope with our changing environment. That's what James meant by plasticity, the ability of the human brain to develop ideas, to test them in experience, to try them out, to see if they helped people deal with the conditions of the world in which they found themselves, and if they didn't, to adapt them or change them or reject them and find better ideas and better beliefs. This is a kind of relativism, there's no question about it, but it's not a solipsism. In other words, it's not just a way of saying whatever makes you feel good is okay. As James said, if that was the test of an idea, then drunkenness would be the supreme condition of human life, which it plainly isn't. It doesn't do to go around being drunk all the time. It doesn't do to go around thinking 2 + 2 = 5. It doesn't go around to be thinking things that the world doesn't recognize and doesn't respond to. There is a physical, real, objective world out there, but the reason that we have been given minds over the course of evolutionary history is not to reflect that world, it's to engage it. That's very much part of Dewey's theory of education, too.
Louis Menand is our guest. His book is called The Metaphysical Club, the story of how, in reaction to the Civil War, a handful of immortal thinkers invented pragmatism. There's another dimension of the plasticity idea that comes from Alan Locke, the Black Rhodes Scholar, sort of Harlem Renaissance thinker, also underlined by W.E.B. Du Bois, but the idea that, and it was radical at the time, especially, you know, given the ideology of Jim Crow, but that identity is not biological or static, much less reflected in skin color, but that it's social and relational. Right. We accept that idea sort of automatically now, but it was a big deal at the time.
That was the hardest idea of the pre-Civil War era to get changed. Part of the reason was that most of Western science supported the notion that race was a kind of central, fundamental, biological category that couldn't be changed, and that your race meant that you had certain characteristics, a certain kind of intelligence, certain kind of aptitude, certain kind of temperament. That was a pre-Civil War way of thinking, and it was also a post-Civil War way of thinking. Now, one of the what I try to argue in the story is that one of the offshoots of pragmatism was this idea of pluralism. And pluralism is the idea that there are different ethnic identities, but that those identities are social. They're created by one's relationship as a member of an ethnic group or racial group with other ethnic or racial groups. And as those relationships change, you change, your identity changes as a consequence of that. That there isn't any fundamental biological determining input based on your race about who you might be. This was a very radical notion of pluralism. It arose at a time when there was a great deal of contention about the what was thought of as the problem of immigration in the 19-teens, 1910 to 1915. And some of the people who were engaged in that debate were students of William James and John Dewey, and I try to talk about some of them in the book. It was not a popular idea, pluralism. The idea, of course, of that period was the melting pot. The idea of pure assimilation to an Anglo-American norm. But today, as you say, the pluralist idea is very much alive in the form of multiculturalism.
We're talking about the invention of pragmatism in reaction to the Civil War, fundamentally built on the notion that it could make it harder for people to be driven to violence by their beliefs. The tag making fun of pragmatism is that it explains everything about ideas except why a person would be willing to die for one. People have died for ideas since the invention of pragmatism. I want to get to the reaction to it. It's very persuasive in this book that pragmatism is not only the American entry in the sort of world catalog of philosophy, but it is the way we live. I mean, it is the virtue of American life in many ways that if it works, we do it. Even that sort of the current cliche, you know, it works for me, is a distillation of the pragmatist idea. But you also say it went out of fashion.
Yeah.
And it lost credit. It may have gone to seed in the sort of early 20th century. What did happen to it? Who attacked it? And did certitude, which they were fighting, ever recover?
Well, yeah, I take a sort of ambivalent position about pragmatism in the book. I try not to be too judgmental about any of the ideas that I discuss in the book because I just think it's a great story. But if you think about pragmatism as a reaction against the Civil War, it is a reaction against abolitionism. It is a reaction against the idea that you should go fight and die for an abstraction. You know, it has an appeal to us because in place of that, it puts the idea of democracy, discussion, conversation, dealing with difference in a peaceful way. On the other side, it doesn't really deal with the fact that many of the good things in human history have come from the activities and deeds of people who have gone to war for principles or sacrificed themselves for principles. It can't really account for that fact of human nature. So I think what happened in the period when pragmatism went into eclipse was it was a period when people did feel, again, Americans too, felt that principle was important, and that pragmatism was too relativistic, it was too experimental, as you say, it was too plastic a philosophy to be of use. And that period was the period of the Cold War. Between 1945 and the end of the 1980s, James, Dewey, and Holmes, who had been...
What about World War II itself? What about Hitler?
World War II as well. World War II was fought against a totalitarian enemy in the name of the principle of freedom and democracy, which were conceived of as principles, not just as experiments or ideas that might or might not work. And, of course, the Cold War was fought against another absolutist evil, communism. So that for many Americans, pragmatism was much too weak a philosophy, too soft a philosophy. Excuse me, to sustain a principled fight. There's a good example, really, of anti-pragmatist thinking in that period, and that's Martin Luther King Jr. Martin Luther King Jr. preached continually against pragmatism, continually against relativism. That was what he thought was the reason why people were willing to put up with
racism. Did he
racism.
Target it head on? I mean, he was anti-violence. I mean, how did he address the pragmatist spirit?
Well, he was a great disciple of Reinhold Niebuhr, the great theologian. It was Reinhold Niebuhr whose works Martin Luther King Jr. studied when he was at Boston University, where he got his doctorate. And Reinhold Niebuhr was a great foe of John Dewey. In the 1930s, he and John Dewey had many exchanges. Reinhold Niebuhr thought, too, that John Dewey was too optimistic, too soft. He didn't take into account the presence of evil in human nature, which is not a pragmatist idea. Pragmatists don't think that human beings are morally corrupt deep down. Reinhold Niebuhr thought this was a crucial insight to understanding things like fascism and communism. And so Martin Luther King thought it was an important insight to understand racism. And he didn't think you could understand racism without having some idea of evil. Martin Luther King was a religious man. It was a religious movement. And there's nothing pragmatic, really, about what he did. He did it. He fought for principle. He was a martyr for principle. And he was a continual preacher against relativism. So that's an example of a kind of something that's typical of Cold War experience in America that really is a departure from the pragmatic tradition. Now, what happened, it's a funny thing, is that almost as soon as the Cold War ended in the late 1980s, 1989, when the wall came down in Berlin, almost as soon as that happened, there was a whole resurgence of interest in Holmes, James, Dewey, and Peirce. And this is the period.
Why?
Well, I think partly because there was an interest in recovering an American philosophical tradition, partly because the reasons why those figures had been neglected for the 40 years of the Cold War had disappeared, that is, the conditions of the struggle against communism, and partly because some charismatic American intellectuals wrote books about them. But it's funny that I started writing this book and conceiving of the book right at the end of the Cold War. And as I was writing the book, more biographies and editions and collections of letters and books about James, Peirce, Dewey, and Holmes came out that had come out in the whole 50 years before that. So I was continually keeping up with this burgeoning literature, and I was confident that my book would be the last book written about these people when it came out.
You're talking, I mean, it was a movement against certitude. You say certitude resurfaced militantly against Hitler, against communism, even in Martin Luther King's case, against segregation. I'm wondering, where else does certitude, religious certitude, political certitude, Republican, Democratic, socialist certitude have to fight for respect in a pragmatic country? I kept thinking of, for some reason, reading your book, I kept thinking of William F. Buckley as sort of an embodiment of, the last embodiment of certitude. But there are others out there. Religious people, too.
Yeah. I think a lot of American political... I mean...
What about scientists? I mean, the Darwinians sort of took on a kind of certitude.
It's quite true. It's funny that Darwinism was the undoing of a certain kind of scientific certitude, and then it's become in our century, and especially recently, I think, has become its own kind of scientific certitude. I think that we talk about pragmatism as a kind of American way of thinking. It's often characterized that way. I think that it is American because it grew out of a specifically American experience, the experience of the Civil War in the period after the war. But I also think that there is a lot of certainty in American life. There is a lot of belief that the universe is an idea. There is a lot of principled talk and principled belief. I think many Americans are pragmatists on one level, and on another level, the level of opinion, let's say, they're not pragmatic at all. So I wouldn't overrate the pragmatic nature of the American character, and certainly not the American political character.
Well, I wonder. There's also, I just wanted to take note, a kind of anti-elitism, almost an anti-intellectualism that runs through the pragmatists, John Dewey in particular. You quote him saying, "Philosophy recovers itself when it ceases to be a device for dealing with the problems of philosophers and becomes a method cultivated by philosophers for dealing with the problems of men." A very healthy admonition, it seems to me. He also says, thinking and acting, this is an interesting one, thinking and acting are just two names for a single process, the process of making our way as best we can in a universe shot through with contingency. That's a very American style.
It is.
We're getting through the day, getting through the month, doing the best we can, as Ronald Reagan said, or as Holmes would say, We'll decide the case and figure out the principle later.
Yeah, Holmes thought that's just the way people make decisions anyway, even if they claim they're doing it the other way around, even if they claim they consult the principle before they make the decision. But yeah, that is a very typical view of Dewey. But, you know, to say that Dewey was anti-intellectual, I mean, if Dewey wasn't intellectual, it's hard to know who was. He wrote 36 books. You know, he was a great educator, a great professor, a great philosopher. One way to think about what he was saying in the first passage that you read, philosophy recovers itself when it becomes a device for dealing with the problems of men, is to say that he was attacking academic philosophy. What he was saying was philosophers have gotten all wound up in questions of epistemology and how do we really know the world and how do we know we exist and are we really brains in a vat and all the kind of traditional abstract problems of philosophical discussion. And in getting wrapped up in those abstractions, it had neglected to confront what was really going on in the world, the problems of men, the social problems. And he thought philosophers could help deal with those problems. How? By unraveling received ideas that people had which got in the way of their ability to see what was really going on in their lives. And that's what he tried to do as a public intellectual for the last 30 years of his career, was to address social problems as a philosopher by pragmatically unraveling all the abstractions and false ideas that people get wrapped up in and get entrapped by. I think that is very American. It certainly is. But it's Dewey's great contribution. But in that sense, it is a little anti-intellectual, as you say.
Anti-academic in any event. Yeah.
Yeah, it's against the idea that, you know, what you need to do to figure out what's going on is to sit in an armchair and think all the time. That's not what Dewey thought. Dewey thought the purpose of thinking was for action. The purpose of thinking was to enable you to do something in the world that you wanted to do. And you couldn't just sit at home and figure out abstractly what the right thing was. You had to try your ideas out in the world. So he was for getting philosophers out of the study. Into the street.
Why do you say it's a philosophy for a new century after the Cold War? What would John Dewey be saying sitting at the right hand of George W. Bush in a one superpower world full of problems to be solved, full of divisions to be bridged?
Well, it's a great question. I don't know what John Dewey would say to George W. Bush. I don't know how he would recognize George W. Bush, what sort of category he would put him in. It's an interesting question about why pragmatism is popular now, again, in the 21st century. I think some of it has to do, let me put it this way, the most important aspect of it that's important is this idea of democracy. The pragmatist idea fundamentally is, this is true even of Peirce, is that in the end, to get ideas that are useful or to get ideas that are pragmatically true, everybody has to contribute because no one person has all the right ideas or the right intuitions. And that is a principle of democracy. So in a world in which a lot of countries around the world are switching to democracy, pragmatism becomes a way of explaining why democracy is the value that should underlie all other values. And I think that's a idea worth exporting.
It's interesting. It reminds you of Michael Dukakis at his acceptance speech saying this is a battle of ideology. Of competence, not ideology. But in American politics, we love that ideological edge, even if with George W. Bush, you think it's kind of an add-on, maybe a phony.
Well, it's an add-on for all of them. I mean, it's just the nature of national politics that if you don't claim to stand up for an idea, but people don't take you seriously. I think Dukakis made a mistake in that. Americans love to hear people stand up for principle. They also like practical and pragmatic people when it comes to actual policy.
I want to go out on just that short line of William James, great writer, great thinker. The universe is plural. This is Jamesian pluralism. It hangs together, but in more ways than one. Reality is distributive. Things are connected loosely, provisionally, and every which way. So is this book. It's a marvelous book, Louis Menand. The Metaphysical Club, A Story of Ideas in America, How the Civil War in Its Aftermath Created an Ism, Pragmatism. Thank you, Luc Menand. Thanks to the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School. And to New England Streaming Media. We had help today from Noel Flatt Jeremy Bowers, Morgan Anderson, and Beth Palmer. The program is produced at the B&MP Studios at the Christian Science Monitor by Tom Tiger, Catherine Bidwell, Jake Shapiro, and Amy McDonald. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Please join us at our website, www.christopherlydon.org.